session number 17729, Rule 5.
Bill Calbrick, Rule 5.
eventually we don't know from all the squadrons, not sure what the squadrons, I didn't keep them in, the squadron numbers, anything else, but we've also done all kinds of special trips and special duties, testing of special equipment. It's all down in the navigator's logbook. We've done a total of tests altogether of 268 tests and various other things until the skipper, in round about May of 1945, and then there was just the six in the crew. There was the navigator, Jeff Padgett, DFC, the skipper, Duke II, DFC and Bar, the bombing mentioned dispatchers, the flight engineer, Taffy Turner, the wireless operator, air gunner, Jack Olson, who lives at Blackpool now, and myself, six for the crew. He said he was going back. And then we used to fly with a squadron leader Ward. He was a test pilot and so on and so forth on these things. And then eventually we had the wing commander operations. The wing commander operations at Waddington was a wing commander, McFarland, who had been the CO of 50 Squadron at Skellingthorpe on his second tour. He had the DSO, DFC and Bar. Then he had a navigation leader who was a squadron leader, a gunnery leader who was a squadron leader, a bombing leader who was a squadron leader, a wireless operator, and so on and so forth. And although we were on base operations, we served a certain amount of time, like the navigator went with the navigation leader, and I went with the gunnery leader, and so on and so forth. So I became his number two at the base, and so on and so forth. So besides having these other duties and flying duties and so on and so forth, we had our own duties on base operation and went around the other stations and squadrons and so on and so forth. And then any special went on. We flew with Wing Commander Tate at one time, who was on the Tirpitz, but he flew several trips with us. Wing Commander McFarlane, Squadron Leader Ward, we flew various personalities and so on and so forth. And then when the war had finished, we were the first Lancaster to arrive at Villa Coublay in France. We went there for 3 days. On board was an Air Commodore Hesketh, who eventually was AOC of 5 Group. And we were flown, eventually we took them round various place bases of Berlin, and we were there about 8 days with them, and so on and so forth. And then we had an Air Commodore Pope, Poppy Pope he was called. And we flew them on various things. And then the crew split up around about September of 1945. The navigator went back to Nassau and so on and so forth. It was demobbed. Skipper was back in Australia. And the squadron on the station at that time was 9 Squadron. And 9 Squadron was a part of Tiger Force. Tiger Force was the Lancasters and Lincolns that were going out to the Japanese theatre of war. But in August 1945, the Japanese war ended. But they decided to send a token force out to India. And 617 was one squadron, and 9 Squadron was the other, going out there. And the squadron commander, the two squadron commanders, were two boffins from Air Ministry of Wing Commander rank. We never knew what the war was all about. They'd had some administrative job. I never even had the 1939 star on, not a decoration. And that, on an operational station, meant a lot to the crews. And when our chap arrived, the morale of the squadron went right down the floor. Until eventually, we got a wing commander out who had the DFC, DFM, and so on and so forth. And the morale picked up right away. And we went out, we were stationed there. We flew out from Castel Benito, Cairo, Lida West, Shaiba, where we stayed for 3 days, which was one hell of a place. From there to Karachi, and Karachi to Salbani. Now, as we were leaving Salbani, the liberators were taken off, and they've gone to the Cocos Islands. And one of the past chairman of my branch of the Aircraft Association, a chap called Joe Carberry, and he was the adjutant, acting CO of the squadron. He was a bomb aimer. I stayed there for about or 6 months, and I had a medical problem. I had the same medical problem after I'd done my first tour of operations.
Do you know what that was?
Well, yes. When I was over one of the targets over Magdeburg, at that time, when we went to Leipzig on one trip, the Pathfinders were late in coming in to bomb, and there was all the bombers were around the target, and we lost 97 aircraft over the target itself. It was then decided in Fire Group that one aircraft would go out a few minutes before the main force, and when he got there, they would send the strength of the winds back. All the aircraft would go over the target too quickly. And then we were the aircraft that was chosen. At that time, we'd done 27 trips, 28 trips. So we went on this particular trip. 29 trips we'd done. And it was on the 30th trip we got knocked hell out of. Because we also were supposed to drop the flare for our aircraft, where to turn, you know, the turning points and all that. But they were already dropped by the German fighters, they knew that, so on and so forth. So we lost an engine going into the target. We lost an engine coming out of the target. And we came down to about 6,000 feet. They sent what they call a scarecrow up. This is like a million candlewatt, so on and so forth. And I was in the turret, and I got the flash of it. Mostly in the right eye. And I was temporarily blinded for just a little while. Now, the fact the crew were going to stay together and everything else, and I'd done one other thing. On the last trip when we came back, we were so overjoyed at completing 30 trips, and we'd had a most harrowing trip. Some of us were always, Jack Olsen and I were always acting the goat in the crew, really. We were really. Always up to some bloody mischief or something. And he dared me to jump out the rear of the aircraft. Now, there's a ladder went up the rear of the aircraft with six little steps. And the skipper was telling us, come on, if you don't go, I said, we're going off in the van, you'll have to walk back the flights and all that, you see. So Jack Olsen said, well, you jump out first, Kelly, then I'll jump after you, see. So I stood on the rear thing with my flying boots on and all my flying kits and all that kind of thing, and jumped and sprained my ankle, you know, so on and so forth. Jack Olsen just came down, just sat on the edge and dropped down that way. Was crafty about it. Well, at the time, it pained me and so on and so forth, and didn't take a lot of notice about it. And then I went on to base operations at Waddington. I was in the mess one night when something happened. My nerve snapped. Something went wrong. And I had to go to the officer's hospital at RAF Cleveleys near Blackpool. And I had to go there under Wing Commander Grace, who was a psychiatrist. And during the time I was limping and I had the problem with the leg, and they examined it and x-rayed it and they operated on it. And done what was supposed to do. Apparently the circulation wasn't right in the right leg and so on and so forth. And they took some veins out and they put me on crutches. I was on crutches about a month. Then it was all right and I came back to my crew and so on and so forth. And then when I was out in India, we were in basha huts and so on and so forth, and the rats of the night time used to go through the rafters and all that kind of carry on. But anyway, I have this reaction of the mind when the right eye was partly affected and something happened to my nerves and so on. And I was flown by the station commander, Group Captain Cribb, from RAF Salbani to Calcutta and put into hospital there. And they found out, really speaking, it was detrimental for me to stay out in India any longer. So I was sent by train, 3-day train journey, to Bombay. And then eventually came home on the Georgic into Liverpool, where we stayed in the river because there was the yellow flag, there was smallpox on board or something. And from there I went to a place called Muswell Hill in London, private nursing home. And I had these things on the mind, and when I got there they put me to sleep for 10 days. You know, cocktails and all that business. They call them bombs.
Of drugs, you mean?
Drugs. And they put me in a bath when I came out of this business after about 10 days with thousands of air bubbles, and they used to say, like, you can get out now. When you come to get out, your muscles are so relaxed you couldn't. But they also had this, what they call ab reaction. You used to get ether and pour it over you, and it would send you in a semi-conscious state. And what was on your mind, whatever you were talking about through your operations, instead of going through in a past tense, you'd go to it if you was going through it then, you see, trying to get it up in mind. I was in there for 2 months and eventually came home from there and I rejoined the squadron. Now, that was peacetime Air Force in 1946. Now, instead of being 21 Lancasters to a squadron and 2 squadrons to a station, they dropped the number of Lancasters to 7 to a squadron. So we had 4 squadrons making 28 Lancasters to the station with 4 squadron leaders and a wing commander flying, with a wing commander engineering and a wing commander administration. And during that time, we were posted to Malta we were there about 3 weeks for some reason or other. So 4 Lancasters took off and went off to Malta. When I come back, I was sent on a course to the Highgate School of Intelligence, where they were training intelligence officers. And it was run by the Americans and so on and so forth. And I didn't know what the connotation was. I didn't, you know, but I'd done the course. It lasted me, say, 6 weeks. Came back to my station and found I'd been posted to Germany, just on my own, to the Missing Research Inquiry Unit. A lot of the aircrew that came down during the war had no known graves, and some of them had been involved with the Italy Youth and weren't in graves and so on and so forth. Now, you know, after the war was over, there was an awful lot of Germans suddenly found out they had an uncle in Scotland or an aunt in England or friends in Australia and so on and so forth. And they were all in these camps who were saying that we didn't know anything about Hitler, we want to get back. And some were genuine. There was an awful lot just swinging the lamp. They had their relatives, a group captain, something like that. And they used to volunteer information. And a lot of it was about the aircrew. A lot of aircrew that came down was shot by the Hitler Youth. And they were mutilated and so on and so forth. So they had no actually known grave. They were buried in other places altogether. And this information was fed back to the people who ran the camps, was the Grenadier Guards and the Irish Guards. And they were rather, you know... Anyway, this information came back to Air Ministry. And then it would come... I was in a section. My unit was commanded by an Air Commodore, with a 2 or 3 group captains and about 8 or 9 wing commanders and so many squad commanders, and the rest of us were flight lieutenants. And I was posted, first of all, I went to the Hook of Holland, to Harwich, then to the Hook of Holland. The first station was Hamburg. And then from Hamburg I was posted to a place called Uetersen. And then from Uetersen I went to Berlin. Now, under this job that we had, we were never in RAF messes. We rose in civilian quarters, and the civilian quarters are run by the CCG, which was a control commission. My opposite number was a Major McConaughey, who was commanding the Graves Commission unit, wherever it was, you know. But the chap who travelled all over Germany with me, and I did travel an awful lot, was a Captain McEwen. He was in the Green Howards, but he was an investigation officer like I was. And we had a Humber sniper car and a couple of Jeeps and all that business. And then we'd meet up with somebody from the Grave Commission unit. And we'd go to the graveyards and so on. I'd be there when they took the coffins up or the sacks or what they were in. And probably skin and bones, but they still had the battle dress on. Means of identification, probably had the tags on. If they didn't have the tags on, you could bet your life some of them had love letters still in the pocket. But if that wasn't the case, you could go by the teeth. Go around the teeth and send the information back to Air Ministry. Or they may have laundry marks on their under trousers or the vest and so on and so forth. So I spent an awful lot of time amongst graves and amongst burials and so on and so forth. I'd done that for about 20 months.
Sounds a horrific job.
Terrible job. And then eventually I was in East Berlin, and the Russians were shocking, really. They used to lock you in your rooms at the night time, and they had a habit of giving you like this raw smoked fish for your breakfast. And then I was posted back to cellar for a time because I started to get some abscesses under my arm and this business of the eye came up. So I went to a convalescent for 3 weeks in cellar. And from there I came back to Hamburg and found out I'd been posted to Rendsburg. And I was responsible for a place called Schleswig-Holstein in Germany, with a spread from Kiel right up to Rendsburg, Flensburg, and the whole of the Frisian Islands. And eventually went to the Frisian Islands, and there we were given a tank landing craft with a German crew, with a naval lieutenant commanding it, and this Captain McEwen and myself and this Major McConaughey. And we were then based at RAF Vesterland. I was based there with this captain as well. And eventually he stayed on the station with me. And the tank landing craft took us all over the Frisian Islands, including Denmark and everything else. We used to go to the local mayor, and some of them weren't very, they weren't cooperative at all. I remember one particular chap. We always had a German interpreter with us, a chap called Hans Johansen. We used to have cucumbers for an awful lot with our salad, and he said, "Do you want any cucumber?" But anyway, this mayor wouldn't cooperate whatsoever. He wouldn't give us any information. And I had with me, my senior NCO was a sergeant, and I got him along with a sergeant out of the army and two corporals to go call on the mayor with rifles, fixed bayonets and everything else. The interpreter, I didn't go. And we ordered them down to the shore. And then we let the thing down with the tank landing craft, and we made him walk out to the water up to his waist and told them that, really speaking, they'd lost the war. We hadn't. We wanted to be cooperative if possible, and we wanted that information. And
he
of course,
was the mayor of where?
He was the local mayor of this one of the Frisian Islands. Probably no more than when you talk about the mayor of Liverpool, we're talking about a population of about, say, about 1,000 people or 2,000. So he's in charge of the local council. And that's how we got the information. So we've done the whole of the Frisian Islands, and a lot of our time was spent at Silt itself, where the submarine bases were, the German submarine bases, which I'd bombed at one time or other with blockbuster bombs.
And were there signs on these bodies of RAF air crew that they'd been executed rather than...
Well, where we found anything that's untoward and wrong, we had a number to ring, and the army used to send out a pathologist to examine the situation. He came out there. And so on and so forth. I know one thing that did happen. When I came out of the RAF, I was sworn on the Official Secrets Act that anything I'd seen and so on and so forth that I would declare and I wouldn't let people know. But when I came out of the RAF after the war, I joined the reserve at Vazakli, where I became assistant adjutant. There was all air crew and all ground crew. There was the ground control unit, which was commanded by a squadron leader, and the station commanded by a squadron leader, Milburn DSO. And I worked for the Liverpool Corporation in the Wards Department at that time. Now the chairman, the chief engineer was a Colonel Hibbard, who was the chairman of the West Lancashire Territorial Army, so on and so forth. And I was sent for one day that they wanted to see me and so on and so forth. And I was given a first class warrant. Apparently the law is in Scotland, before you can chap say he's deceased and all this kind of carry on, you've got to have somebody who was there at his burial or there at his grave or saw his remains. And I was let off for 3 days by the corporation. The RAF paid me, they paid me for the week as a flight lieutenant, went up there and went to court and swore an affidavit to the effect that I was there when it happened and so on and so forth. And I remember them asking me at the time, they'd read my report and all this business, and what did I find and all that, so I wasn't allowed to say anything. Now, in the Times, about 4 or 5 years ago, there was a chap who'd been the deputy governor or governor of something of Bermuda or Jamaica it was. He'd come back to this country, he'd been a flight engineer. He was shot down over Germany, and he was a dark skin, he was a Negro. But on his shoulder straps, it was Jamaica. Now, Jamaica at that time, under the lease and land business, was partly under the jurisdiction of America because of the four funnel destroyers they let us have under the Lease and Land Act and all that business. And his crew was shot down, and Hitler Youth came along and shot every member of his crew, but not him, because they thought he was American. Dark-skinned, and this Jamaican across here. And when he came back to England, he put in the Times about this particular job and what had happened and so on and so forth. Well, I've never said anything about it because there's no point. I've never tried to say what we did do, what we didn't do, and what we were involved in. There wasn't much to tell. It was a job. I stayed in the RAF until about the middle of 1948. I came home on leave. I think it was a flight lieutenant then. My wife, I'd found a house for the first time. We had a baby boy called Barry, our only son. We've got two daughters, Leslie and Meryl. And Barry was born in 1944, and that was the time I was commissioned. I was commissioned in the July, and he was born in the October, but my commission didn't come through until the October. Anyway, came home, and they'd found the house, and the gas in the house. There wasn't electric and all that kind of carry on, and she was living on her own in the house. And when I got back, I found out that my CO, who was a squadron leader above me, he'd been posted and put in command. Instead of me being up in the Schleswig Islands, I was brought back to Germany, to Hamburg, and had a proper situation there. And eventually I was given official quarters on the station. And the chap above me was a flight lieutenant. And in his section, there were five of us, one flight lieutenant, two flight lieutenants under him, I was second in command to him, and two flying officers. And I had a staff car and everything, because what would happen if he went, he used to go on to visit the other stations and other places and all that. It was just a swan, really, you know, swanning, really. So when he went away and he went on leave, I had his official car. Now, it was funny on that station. The base commander was a squadron leader, and there was a German orchestra who used to play during meals, because in those days there was short of food and everything else, so they played for the peasants. But it was all nicely done with German waitresses and everything else, and it was known on the station that I was the only flight lieutenant with a Humber Snipe, which was a staff car. I remember going to the German cinema there and seeing The Wizard of Oz. Well, when I came back, I found that my area had been completely done differently altogether. I was sent to another section, and I got to thinking about home, so I came out the RAF. I could have stayed in. When I told them I was going to pack up, I had to go and see this Air Commodore, group captain then, commanding us. And he said, well, you can stay until 1952-53. He said, we'll extend your commission, and so on and so forth. I said, my wife's got a house, lives on her own, so on. He said, sometime your wife might be able to come out here, bring your son with you. Now, I went home and put it in my wife. She didn't want that type of life, didn't want it at all. She wants me out the RAF, and so on. And I honestly thought, I went back to my company I used to work with in Duke Street. I was in my RAF uniform with a brevi up and ribbons and a flight lieutenant. I honestly thought it would be a piece of cake getting a job. And all the lads turned out the whole place and cheered me, and I was invited into the director's room. They gave me a collection of around about £23, and £23 was a lot of money in 1948. And then the directors took me upstairs and said to me, well, you know, most of the lads that you know, he said, were all privates or corporals. He said, there's nobody got to the rank above a corporal. He said, even the chap who used to be in charge of section, a chap called Butler, Alf Butler. Now, he was an MT driver in the RAF, a corporal. I remember his wife used to say to me, I just saw Billy Kelbrick, do you know he's a corporal? When I was acting corporal, and when she saw him as a sergeant, well, the next time she saw him, I was commissioned. And she said, he went to him, and he told me, he said, Billy Kelbrick, sir, do you know he's an officer? And she said, if you and I see him again, tell me he'll get into bloody trouble if he doesn't take uniform. He's all right to have a arm and all that carry on. Anyway, he said, we can't give you a job back. But she said, there's a collection here of £23, and the firm is going to give you a £5 note on top of that. And they gave me one of those white £5 notes, you know. So it was the real luxury. There's no point in coming back here. If I was you, stay in the RAF. So I said, yes, I'd do that. But within 6 months, I came out the RAF. And then I worked for the local corporation as a local government officer until I joined the reserve exactly, and stayed in that for 4 years. Went to camp, various camps, and then I joined the Aircrew Association 18 years ago, and then became the founder, member, secretary, which I still am, of the Merseyside branch. I've been there for about 50 years. And then, of course, I became on the Squadron Association as the social secretary, and then became the secretary 2.5 years ago.
Do you think that that nervous problem that you had was because of the operation?
So they tell me. Something happened recently. I went and I had problems with the eyes. You see, if I look at your, of course, my left eye, and look at you, that you've got no face at all, just a buzz going round. I can see part of your right arm, your left arm. I can see your. If I concentrate, take my eyes away from your face, I can know you've got a penny hand, and you see your shoes and all that business. This was discovered many, many years ago, and they found out what they call central changes at critical site. What happened was that when I came back from India and I came out of the RAF, I was in a corporation around about 1952, 53. And one day I had this terrible pain. I couldn't see and everything else and so on and so forth. And I went to a chap called Mackay Reid, who was well known insofar as opticians concerned. That was in St. Paul's Hospital in, just forget where it was, in town. And eventually he sent me to the Northern Hospital where I had lumbar punctures, which is a shocking and painful thing. And they found out what they call central changes of the critical site. I was watching television one night, around about 1953, and there was a speck on the announcer's nose. And I said to my wife, there's a speck on the announcer's nose. And I remember saying, well, brush it off, it's a dust, and it was still there. And when I looked around, I found I had this situation. And I'd had a lot of nervous problems, this nervous cough. I thought it was just a nervous cough. And eventually, I went back to corporation, and I was advised by the medical authorities. I think I've been in the corporation about 7 years, when they said, I went from there and became assistant registrar of one of the colleges, and so on and so forth. But then I had further problems. I had to go in hospital again regarding the sight and nerves and so on and so forth. I was advised then I should get an outside job, and of course I did. I got the chance of my lifetime. There was a firm called Corus Tractala, and they were the exporters from Southern Ireland to this country. They were cooperative where they could bring it through rates cheap and all that business. And I was with them 4 years, and then I was on the quay one day when this major came down with his Royal Artillery tie on, and I had my RAF tie on. He said, are you Bill Carver? Yes. Oh, you're in the RAF? I said, oh, you know. Okay. He said, we're looking for a chap to take over and do this and that. Well, I started with a firm called Janelle. I was with them for about 25 years. Wonderful job. I became their director in this country and so on and so forth. But throughout that time, I still had my problems with nerves and so on and so forth. And last year, I had I'd had various operations and all that business, but I had operations on the leg. The circulation was bad and so on and so forth. And eventually I got a war pension. I got a lump sum, and then they took the lump sum off me and gave me a proper pension. And about 2 or 3 years ago, I had further problems, and they reassessed me and so on and so forth.